Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
It's been a busy week here in Washington, D.C., and in international affairs all over the globe. But as usual, it is time to introduce the normal roundtable of Backroom Politics. I am your host, J.T. Russell. With me, as always, from 4 to 6 on Tuesdays, starting off with our House Congressional Advisor. He is the former 8-term member of Congress from Washington's 2nd District. He is the author of the passage of the National Voter Registration Act, otherwise known as Motor Voter Bill, and he is also a partner and principal of the Congress of the 9th. He is Al Smith. Welcome to the show, as always, Al.
I resent being called normal.
No. You like work? That's obscure. He is a 35-year veteran of Washington politics. He is the former minority counsel for the House Rules Committee. He is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford and former vice president of government affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is currently a principal at Collings, Swift, and Hines. He is the Honorable Bob Hines.
Glad to be. I had to fight through an ice storm.
I know you did. Thank you. After working all day, the salt driveway. He's the director of Eurasia Center. For their Eurasia Center's China program. He's vice president at the Eurasia Center of the D.C. and New York bars, and he is international affairs. God, however we want to call him, he is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Welcome back to the kind of. You own this crap.
So when I was wonderful.
Exactly. Oh,
he can bring. Always, he is the executive. Society of ours. He is a former member of the DHS White House. Currently a master's candidate at American University. He is Perry Blackstein. Perry, welcome back.
Good to be here, Justin.
We have a lot of stuff to go over. We've got a full agenda for today, 2 hours to be able to cover. But for those listening out there in Radio Land, I'll give out our call number. You can call us at 619-638-8477. That is 619-638-8477. And we're leading off right now with breaking news coming out of Pakistan. You know, that country cannot catch a break. There is reports coming out of Pakistan. Is critical, which is now becomes a national security issue because that is right outside the major airspace that the Black Forces use in response to the front in Afghanistan. They just got dissension in the ranks up in the north. It is politically unstable. The infrastructure has been trapped in the earthquake. This has got to have Foggy Bottom in this completely out of their mind crazy as what do we do here. Round, you're our international expert. I mean, can this country survive a 1.4 magnitude earthquake in one of the more populous parts of the region?
It can recover. The key is the key has always been to ensure make sure that the Pakistanis are able to combat Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The Chinese, of course, are very strong influence over there, and everyone is watching this very closely. The U.S. has to continue their involvement. They have to continue developing the relations, not only with the government, but in the people in the rural areas, and that has been very effective. The distribution of aid is going to be very crucial, similar to. And I think the compassion and the generosity of the American people is going to shine through.
Bob, you know, you've been familiar with goings on in Pakistan. Everybody inside Washington politics, Pakistan's been kind of a powder keg politically, good or bad, arguably. What do you think about now having to deal with a 7.4 earthquake? You know, a key region on our front on the Afghanistan war.
Well, Justin, I agree with everything that Ralph said, and I look at it this way. That's a relatively weak democratic government. The military and the security apparatus is probably the strongest force in the country, and of course, over the last 30, 40 years, at least half the time, they have been running the country, and there has not been a democratic government. What's scary about this? The country could come apart if a lot of aid isn't there quickly, because if it comes apart, the military takes over. We, in our efforts to rid the Taliban of any strength and power in Afghanistan, may suffer severely because a lot of the military and the security apparatus are very good friends with the Taliban, and they up in the Northwest Territories, they're just not fighting them at all because they want to protect them. They feel that they are their balance in Afghanistan. So, you know, if the country comes apart and the military takes over, we could be suffering a great deal in our efforts in Afghanistan.
Well, you know, Al, this reminds me of, you know, one of the quotes that was attributed to a colleague of yours in the House, the late Charlie Wilson. Charlie Wilson was a huge proponent of, you know, we're in there. We've been in Pakistan. We're heavily involved in the political stability or trying to maintain stability that's favorable to the Western allies. Charlie Wilson said, don't put military in there. We can't abandon them. Now is the time we have to have organizations like USAID, organizations like the Red Cross in there, the humanitarian efforts. We need to contribute to the infrastructure. Congressionally, is this something that would be on the radar on the Hill? Is this something that they can help drive the administration to say, look, we can't afford to abandon this, especially in this time of austerity?
I think that the Congress can do this if they don't instead decide that it needs a military response. I think with a lot of members, they say, oh, my God, the Army's going to take over. It's going to be worse. We better gear up our armaments to deal with this. And that was exactly what Charlie was saying. We've done that. He was talking about Afghanistan.
Right.
We've done the military thing. Now we need to go in and help these people develop a democracy. And there will be those in Congress that will want to do that. And there will be those in Congress who will think that that's some kind of a pussy thing, you know, to do that's weak and ineffective.
Ralph, you know, we've seen the political instability that's been going on in Pakistan, you know, with, you know, the turnover of the Bhutto government or the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. Now, this prime minister, that has been it's been viewed as a tremendously weak government, that the military is starting to regain some resurgence in power, but we're also seeing the frontier of Pakistan where there's some alliances with the warlords in Afghanistan, the Taliban. Does this pose an opportunity for an organization north to come in and destabilize the government of Pakistan trying to deal with another natural disaster?
It does pose an opportunity for the Taliban if the U.S. does not deal with the issue of corruption in Pakistan. You have to win over the hearts and minds of the people. And part of that is helping to reform the government, helping to connect with the people in the rural areas, making sure that they're supportive of the government and the U.S. policy.
Al?
Could I ask a question of Ralph? There are a number of places in the world where if we could only make the corruption go away, we would have much simpler problems on our hands.
Yeah.
Corruption in many countries is, in fact, cultural. And not just a of, like in the United States, you actually put them in the place of the culture expected. And, I'm not sure if it's possible for outside democracy, anyone as successful as ours, who can demonstrate that you can run a strong government without corruption,
Well, we've tried bringing in Western trained and educated leaders to instill I think the key is pointing out what a horrible alternative there would be if the Taliban or Al-Qaeda were to take over Pakistan and people who are under that kind of regime.
I mean, right now, you know, Pakistan, the government of Pakistan, they've got the issues up in the northern frontier. They, again, are still trying to recover their infrastructure from the floods of last year, as well as still you have the Kashmir issue, which is still a conflict between Pakistan and India. You know, and now this. Can the sway to go back to supporting a centralized government in Pakistan, or be too far gone, we're going to have to start from scratch?
We have to have our people there on the ground working directly with the people to show them how to develop the ideal society, if you want a better phrase, where corruption can be eliminated and you can have a functioning society. That's very difficult. I believe they can be a
very vital, even if we can't get everything in the next couple of weeks. We've got to have people visible. We've got to have people talking about what we're bringing in there to try to help them, because if we don't, I think the Taliban and other people who don't wish us to be able to speak to the people and say the whole thing.
And we're back. Sorry for that break in sound there. When we talk about what's going on in Afghanistan or in Pakistan, you know, we saw the American people become supportive of telethons for the Haiti earthquake. We saw them being supportive of the disaster and the tsunami in the Pacific. Does the American people have enough belief and enough support in Pakistan that they might be supportive of, like, let's say, a telethon in support of a Red Cross support to Pakistan? Does the American people cowboy up the money and the support and the relief to Pakistan, which is, you know, arguably viewed as either a fair weather friend at best, if not somebody who's working against us in the shadows? Ralph.
I think you're going to have some, some notable politicians lead the way, sort of like what Clinton did with Haiti. And that way, people will jump on that wagon and be willing to support reconstruction efforts in Pakistan. Again, that's going to be the key, because if you just let the nation crumble, it would be devastating for our interests in Pakistan.
I agree with Ralph's if. I just don't think it's going to happen.
Al, on that note, do you think that we should be hearing from Secretary Clinton on this issue within the next 24 hours. Do you think that Secretary Clinton is going to come out with a full relief and support package of supporting that type of effort in Pakistan?
I certainly think she's going to make efforts in that direction. How successful it will be, I don't know. My guess is she will not come out with a full bore, we've got to get in there, let's go, fellas, until they've tested the water and found out what the public opinion is in that regard. She could find herself leading a parade with nobody following.
Right. Okay, we're coming up on the break right now. And as we're doing that here in the smoke-encrusted center of backroom politics, we've got the big screen on CNN, and right now as we're finishing up our first segment, President Hun Jintao is now arriving in the U.S. He is at Andrews Air Force Base with Vice President Biden and the full Chinese entourage. We're going to be talking about the Chinese state visit and what's going on, and there's some rhetoric that's being ratcheted up against China and the financial situation, the political situation. So we'll talk about that when we come back. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom. We will be back in 2 minutes.
All right.
And welcome back. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. With me as always, Al Swift, Bob Hines, Ralph Winnie, our executive producer, Perry Blasting. As we went to the break, we were watching the big screen billboard behind us here in Shelley's, and it was showing Chinese President Hu Jintao arriving here. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
You are.
Well,
yeah.
Okay.
President Hu.
Hu Jintao is just arrived here in the United States over at Andrews Air Force Base. They will be making their way here downtown. Lots of security, lots of pomp and circumstance going on. Al, you are absolutely amazing. What are you laughing at? I've got to know. What is amusing to you?
Who's on first?
I wasn't going to say that, but it's like a bad apple. President Hu's here. We're just going to refer to him as Hu Jintao, just for the lack of familiarity with that and some of the younger crew. President Hu Jintao has been the state dinner has been planned and the state visit, which is critical right now to our relationship with the Chinese government. It has been, for lack of a better term, somewhat strained of recent over both economic and political issues. Whether you want to bring in the North Korean issue, whether you want to bring in the devaluation of the dollar versus the Chinese monetary system. There's a lot of pressure on this right now. Ralph, what, in your opinion, why is this significant today in the current political facets of what we're dealing with right now? Why is this visit so important?
Well, I think coming off of the global financial crisis, there are four issues that the Chinese are very concerned about on this visit to D.C. One is indigenous innovation policy. The other one is intellectual property and access to market economy status. And, of course, the last one and the most and the major stumbling block is the problem with the exchange rate. So the Chinese are really looking for significant steps forward in all these different areas.
Well, you know, there's a couple of bills in both the House and the Senate right now that's calling for President Obama, literally urging President Obama to confront the Chinese on what one bill is calling currency manipulation. Is it that dangerous?
Well, I think it is, especially for American companies that are doing business in China. We're involved in real estate projects in China, and we, just being there on the ground, we know that land costs, labor costs, construction costs are all going up, and the Chinese are very fearful that allowing the exchange rate to float would affect the real estate industry, and you would have a huge crash. And many of the people that have money, that have disposable income in China, do not remember what it was like just to struggle to stay alive. The older generation, if there was any problems, they would just hunker down and deal with it. This new generation in China is becoming more Western, becoming more affluent, and they want to live the American dream within their controlled and ordered system, which provides economic stability.
Legislatively, when we look at the House and the Senate coming up with actions against China, excuse me, I mean, nothing more than just we want you to, President Obama, this. We strongly urge you to take this action. Is there any strength in any legislation that could come out of the House right now that would force the administration's hands to take action against the Chinese right now, Al?
No, I don't think out of the House or out of the Senate or out of the Congress. What do you do to force the Chinese to do anything? You have to negotiate this. This is a place that's where diplomacy is called for, and getting tough with China or some other similar approach is nonsense. Also keep in mind, and I'd like to ask Ralph if he agrees with this. I only read it one place, but somebody said, you know, we sit here so worried about China, and we forget the fact that China is very worried about us, which if we keep that in mind, it rather suggests the room we have for diplomatic maneuvering rather than, oh, my God, the Chinese are coming, and what do we do to our wives and children? You know, it's just not the case. Would you agree with that?
Well, the Chinese are very concerned about the financial situation because they have a lot invested in the treasury bonds. There's also, there are a lot of Chinese companies that would like to come into the U.S. and to do business with the Americans, but they feel very unwelcome. And that's a major stumbling block, considering Sinopec and a couple of the other major Chinese companies, when they've tried to come in here to work with Americans, they've received a tremendous amount of bad publicity, forcing them to pull out of deals that would be beneficial for both Americans and the Chinese.
But we have American companies that are targeted the Chinese market who make the same kind of complaints, that they can't get through the licensing process forever, et cetera.
And ironically, you know, on that point, you know, it out of all of the possible pieces of legislation that you'd expect bipartisanship on, this is actually one that's got bipartisanship support. You've got Senator Chuck Schumer on board with Senator Lindsey Graham. You know, two opposite ends of the spectrum, but they are all stating, in Senator Schumer's words, the time for talk is over and now is the time for action. I mean, they're really calling, more notably, Secretary Clinton and Secretary Geithner to the carpet saying, hey, what's going on here?
Well, the one thing those two guys have in common, certainly not political philosophy, but they are practical people. They are pragmatists. And that's what's brought them together in spite of their philosophical.
And people forget, I mean, the Chinese were allowing the currency to float. Then came along the global financial crisis, and the fall of the major companies in the U.S. and in Europe. And the Chinese got very worried that it would have a negative impact on their economy. So they tightened the reins.
Right. Bob?
Ralph, I'd like to ask you a question, stepping back from just the economic problems that the two countries have with each other.
Sure.
Some things I've seen in recent articles and whatnot, that one of the problems right now within China is that the military seems to be enhancing their power to influence policy as the time comes for a change of government and a change of a lot of the top leadership in the civilian side. And it looks as though that's one of the reasons that they're getting tougher on a lot of things with us and sort of sticking their thumb in our eye every once in a while. Is this something occurring in your judgment?
Well, the military, there's no question they're getting stronger in China. But what you're seeing with the growth of the middle class is they're starting to, that they're going on blogs and they're criticizing the Chinese government. I mean, people forget there's a lot of talk and debate about how do you make democracy work within this controlled and ordered system of government that we have. And there are different elements within the Communist Party. You have your Pol Pot group, you have your Boris Yeltsin group, and you have your people that want to trade and deal with the West. The problem is, the Chinese are very suspicious of foreigners. If you go back to their history, they've been told what to do, they've been forced to do things that were not in their interest. So they're naturally very adverse to initially dealing with foreigners. So for the government to promote these new policies and to encourage the people to engage with the West is a very positive thing.
Well, we've even seen Secretary Gates has come back. He just came back from a trip to China, working with their military, and he's even stressed some concerns of, is in fact the civilian government in Beijing in charge of the Chinese military, or is the Chinese military running unchecked? I mean,
the key is going to be the growth of the economic policies. As long as people are doing well economically and are moving out of becoming upper middle class and being able to make money, you're going to see the military is not going to have the power. If the economy slides back and you have people that are barely struggling to stay alive, which has traditionally been what's occurred in China, that's when the military would be able to step in.
So that probably means, Ralph, that all these economic currency situations we're talking about are not going to get resolved.
No.
On top of the fact now that, correct me if I'm wrong, Ralph, the Chinese are dealing with something that Americans deal with every day. They're dealing with inflation.
And that's what they fear, because if there's massive inflation and this upwardly mobile middle class starts to suffer, that's where you could see a real revolution. It's not like it was in the old days where people had nothing, and if things got worse, they would just hunker down and deal with it. This emerging mobile middle class has tasted the American dream, and they're going to and that's what they want. They're not going to want to suffer. Go back to what the parents and will look for a new administration.
Now the Hu Jintao government is scheduled to either go up for re-election but right now their current term ends in 2012. Internationally, how is Hu Jintao viewed as a business, a supporter of business, the economy, a free market style or a hybrid thereof of communism and free market?
It's his government that is very supportive of this hybrid of free market capitalism within the control and order system of a communist framework. What's interesting is that the next two leaders from China that are going to take over in China, you have one that is fairly free market, and you have another person that is more more traditional, more supportive of the communist government, supportive of the people, who was very concerned that they would both be competing for power. So it's set up that both of them are going to share power in a sense.
Al?
I find Ralph's comments about the growing middle class to be surprising. I haven't been paying attention. I'm not arguing with you. I'm just saying that something occurred to me 2 days ago that really reinforces what you said. I went to a doctor, and she was Chinese. I could not hear a single accent in her language. She had been here 6 years. She and her husband was also Chinese. She said, furthermore, she said, you know, sometime in the future, we may move back. Now, that was stunning to me. I think most Americans figure that anybody gets out of a communist country, and there's no way you're ever going to drag them back with a tank pulling them there. Here's a very educated woman with a very educated husband who says, yes, we may move our family. We'll see what happens there.
And she's still very connected with her culture, her family. She'll want to go back and see her parents. It's a sign of success for her to be over here and to make money and to, in effect, live the American dream. But at the same time, she wants her kids to experience Chinese culture and their heritage. And that is so important.
Do you foresee a time when people start talking about the Chinese dream?
Possibly. I mean, you know, they're trying to emulate our model, but they're very concerned about order, control, and stability. And that's why most Chinese don't understand this issue of human rights. To them, human rights is freedom from hunger, disease, poverty, which they have read about. Well, they haven't read about it. They know people that have come up through that. And for most Americans, it's the older generation remembers the Depression, but I've never known someone that went to bed hungry. If you ask the average Chinese person, they know some people that don't went to bed hungry, but maybe lost their hearing because they didn't have enough rice. They know friends and relatives that were killed by the Japanese. So it's a very big issue for them. This whole struggle to stay alive has created a belief that, you know, we want to achieve this comfortable economic existence, but we want order, control, and stability. We're not concerned about different political parties, except maybe on a theoretical level at this point.
What
the next generation is going to be the one that has studied and worked in the U.S. and is exposed to the American ideal.
Bottom line, what does Beijing expect to get out of this state visit to Washington?
They would like a market economy access. I don't think they're going to get that. They would like...
Is China preferred? They're not preferred nation. They're not preferred trade status, correct? They don't have the designation of most... Right.
Yes. But this is what they would like.
They would like that.
Yeah.
Do you foresee that happening?
As we move forward, but not right now. The tensions are a little too high.
Okay.
I don't see intellectual, that. Indigenous innovation policy is a big issue for them.
They're now go...
For, and their ability of companies to be able to career, not have to deal with the national security implications.
Now,
I don't see that happening in Congress simply because most members of Congress think that most favored nation station is somehow an unusually high compliment you're paying. It means standard trade relations is what it means.
Right.
It doesn't mean that they are most favored. And if you could get rid of the term most favored, we could get a lot of more people included in that.
Right. Bob.
And I suspect that the United States business community and the labor unions would oppose it as long as they are, quote, manipulating their currency, causing the union wider until some settlement there, probably going to be
let's look at the fact right now is that, you know, we'll talk business. We're talking about a country where a majority of their industries are subsidized by the government, whether it's shipbuilding, auto manufacturing, and yet, even though it is subsidized by the government, we're still seeing, I mean, we saw Berkshire Hathaway invest in China in a way that I've never seen before. We're talking about Warren Buffett's successor being a Chinese national. That has got to be disturbing to big business unions as well as, you know, the rest of the Western economic world. Am I misreading that, Ralph, or are we on the spot with that?
Well, I mean, is that based on a stereotype, or is it a belief that the Chinese are out to get us, or is it, that's all issue. People said the same thing about the Jews. I mean, that, you know, they had too much control and power, and we should watch out for them.
Well, I hear what you're saying. Yeah. It's not so much a criticism.
Yeah.
Is what we're seeing is, you know, labor is definitely focused on the fact that we are losing jobs. You know, when forgive me, Ralph, the large auto manufacturer in China, I forget the name of that organization, that wants to now start importing vehicles to the United States.
Sure.
That's got the UAW up in arms. There's no way that a subsidized car manufacturer, even though we deal with it with Hyundai, we deal with it with Toyota, those are all receive federal subsidies from their internal governments. But
it
for
should
some
make
reason,
us more competitive. I mean, by working with them or in partnership, allowing them into our country, creating jobs and economic stability. I don't want them going to Iran. I don't want them closing up with Venezuela. I want them to have a closer relationship than they would with a lot of these rogue regimes, or even the Russians. I mean, that's what Nixon's strategy was. He wanted to have the Chinese very close to the U.S. act as a buffer against
Russia. Keep your friends close and your enemies close.
Absolutely. Right.
What could possibly derail the current upward swing in the Chinese economy right now and make it less desirable for them to have a free market society over there? Are there any powers that are in play?
Well, if one of the other interest groups within the Communist Party decides to take control. But the government is smart. They're polling their people, and the people are very supportive of the amount of economic freedom that they have in their country.
Okay. Barry?
Well, we're getting ready to go into a break.
Right.
And when we come out of it, we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the rhetoric. Continue that conversation which you had last week about the rhetoric and the civility dialogue that's gone on in the wake of the tragedy in Arizona. And I want to reiterate a point that was made in this last segment about Senators Schumer and Graham, that they've come together despite political differences on pragmatic legislation. In a civil way, they've engaged in dialogue, and as you know, we sit here, you know, kind of as members of a parent organization, the First Congress Society, where we've been speaking about bringing civility back on the political spectrum, I think it's important to note that it's not just on domestic agenda issues, but also on international issues.
Absolutely.
So it is good to hear that. And this isn't the first time that Lindsey Graham and Chuck Schumer have come together on issues like that and said, look, this is just what makes sense. Better.
All right. This is Dr. Politics Live. With me as always, every Tuesday, Al Swift, Bob Hines, Ralph Winnie, our executive producer, Barry Blasstein's walking around aimlessly somewhere.
I'm back.
I'm your host, JT Russell. We've got breaking news coming out of Washington, D.C. here, an actual very sad note. A truly great American has passed away today. CNN just announced the death of Sergeant Shriver, who was truly a great political figure as part of the Kennedy political organization. He himself was a true humanitarian. Shriver family big with Special Olympics. The Shriver family big with he was truly a beloved individual and a beloved figure. I want to spend a couple of minutes here just kind of talking about Sergeant Shriver. Obviously, you know, the Shriver and the Kennedy legacy family is starting to fade away a little bit. The passing of Eunice Shriver last year. We've got now the passing of Sergeant Shriver. Al, you had interactions with Sergeant Shriver.
Well,
you
no,
knew...
I didn't mean to make it sound like I was a bosom buddy.
No.
But he came during the McGovern campaign, and he was running as vice president, and he came to Everett, Washington, where my predecessor, my congressman, meets. And had a chance to spend a little time with him. And usually you can tell when an important figure is just being nice to you or whether they are really listening to you and care what you have to say, even if it's small talk. And he was one of those who listened and gave you respect as you were respecting him. It's not unusual, but it's rare enough to be worth mentioning.
Bob, what are your thoughts on the passing of Sergeant Shriver?
I didn't know him at all.
Right.
In any personal sense. Never met him. I was always impressed by the fact that he never seemed to be interested in self-aggrandizement. He was always interested in doing something good. The Peace Corps is a perfect example. The Special Olympics, which his wife, Eunice Kennedy Shriver, created... He also worked very hard on that, and he always seemed to want to do things that were worth doing. And you got to respect somebody like that. I mean, here was a man who had money, he had family relationships with high political people. He could have just sat around and kippitzed and played golf or played polo or did whatever he wanted to do, but he didn't. He spent his time and he spent his life helping other people. And I think that's a marvelous tribute to anyone.
You know, I got to say, this is actual. I've got a personal interest in this, only because Sergeant Shriver and Eunice Kennedy Shriver, who were instrumental in establishing the Special Olympics program, tremendous organization, tremendous efforts by that family to truly promote those with special needs and getting them active. Have all their own. A lot of people don't know my nephew, my sister's middle son, Alec, is with Down syndrome, and I know that you know, the buddy program that the Shrivers are actively involved in, the Special Olympics, is something that he gets great joy out of, even just participating a little bit. We're very fortunate that my nephew's is very functional. He outstanding little kid. Love him dearly. But when you see the passing of somebody who dedicated their life to making sure that all were included, all kids were included, and even adults with special needs as they grew up, everybody was included. And that, we just don't see that type of selfless, apolitical establishment here in Washington anymore. It's an anomaly. And every time we see the passing of somebody like Sergeant Shriver, it's just one more brick out of that building that we may never see that again, Al.
And one other thing, in the day when we're talking about civility and what have you, he was a happy warrior. He was like Humphrey, in the sense that he was a very positive campaigner. and I'm trying to think of the name of the Buffalo Bills quarterback.
Jack Kemp.
Was another happy warrior, and we need more of those.
Jack Kemp, the former congressman from Buffalo, upstate New York.
Wonderful man,
great legacy, a huge advocate for civilian politics as well. But I agree with you. You know, we're losing that type of statesmanship. You know, that hopefully we can get back again, but it's going to be hard to reclaim that kind of legacy.
And he was a vice presidential candidate.
Under the McGovern campaign. But you know, the one thing that strikes me, and unfortunately, you know, we in today, you know, the younger generation, you know, short of you being a true political wonk, the younger generation doesn't know of figures like Sergeant Shriver and what kind of an impact his loss is going to have on the political scene, just the philanthropic scene here in Washington, D.C. It's an impact. It's that. Our thoughts and our prayers go out to the Shriver family, who are still very much here, a part of the Washington scene. Thoughts and prayers go out to him. He will be greatly missed here in Washington. Let's get back to the agenda real quick. We're getting back to the crux of talking about civility in politics. Everybody is talking about civility in politics now. It seems to be the big bandwagon everybody's jumping on. We have seen everybody from the president who I love everybody's opinion, gave what I believe, even as a Republican, I got to tell you, gave an absolutely phenomenal speech. He was that day when he spoke in Tucson at the University of Arizona. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree with what is really the overwhelming reaction to it. I was startled to hear all the cheering and the clapping and the applause, and then they showed me the size of the audience, and that rather explained it. But I've never been to I've never seen a memorial service that had a lot of aspects of
a political rally?
Of a political rally. It wasn't, there was nothing partisan about it, but it had a political rally or a sports event of some sort. But the president sobered the audience down considerably just by the nature of what he said and the way in which he said it.
You see, I disagree with you on one aspect. In watching the speech, I heard the cheers. I mean, there weren't, arguably, it was done on a college campus. It was done with a lot of college students there. I mean, having the president in your field house, in your stadium, is going to be, you know, generate, especially with the younger generation that was supportive of Obama in 08. A lot of those kids now are now going into the upperclassmen ranks at these universities, including University of Arizona. I think that there was, and not knowing personally Congresswoman Giffords, but knowing, you know, what we read about and the people who I do know that have interacted with her, it's almost like that was something she would like and appreciate as far as a memorial service. That it was, I agree with you that the president brought it up and then brought it down and then brought it up again. It was almost a celebration of her fight for life and a celebration of the lives of those who lost their lives, including, you know, Judge Roll. So I disagree. I think it was very appropriate for that time. I think that's exactly what Tucson needed and the nation needed, quite honestly.
No, you're not. And I didn't mean to make it sound like I was being terribly critical. I was surprised. It was not.
Yes, it's not something
for me to hear. But once they took the long audience, and I realized they were basically a stadium,
right?
Then it began to fit.
Right, Perry.
And I absolutely agree with that. I think that while many of us were surprised watching on TV, and a lot of the criticism was out of an emotion of surprise that, oh, I thought this was a memorial service, not a political rally. I got to tell you, I'm willing to bet that the university students, the thousands of undergraduate students in the audience walking into that, not practically a stadium, it is a stadium, walking into that venue, we're not walking in to eulogize and we're not walking in to mourn necessarily, but we're walking in to celebrate life, we're walking in to stand together in unity at moving beyond this tragedy, and I think that it was completely appropriate for the president to have a speech in that interest. And while there certainly were times where the speech, you know, brought the mood down a little bit before it picked back up, people were not there to hear eulogy after eulogy. It was, as Justin said, a celebration of life and moving together.
I'll go along with that.
And just for those of you who are listening and joining us at the top of the hour, you're listening to Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room. If you'd like to join the conversation, we invite everybody out there that's listening. Call in 619-638-8477. Again, that's 619-638-8477. Our roundtable is ready to take your calls and questions about this or any subject you wish to talk about. Bob, you had a comment you were wanted to.
Well, I wanted to add one thing. I thought it was very wonderful, good idea too, that Senator McCain wrote a wonderful article, an op-ed page article the next morning. It was in the Washington Post, in effect, praising the president for his, what he was trying to do, you know, bring us together. And McCain said it's exactly what we needed. And I was pleased to see that because I know that the two of them had a strained relationship since the election, and I was very glad to see McCain reach out and do that. I think it is a very good sign when the former nominee of the party, who is obviously one of the leaders of the party and people listen to what he has to say, heard that from him directly, and I think it's very important. It helps us to move a little bit towards some civility.
You know, and we talk about civility. I mean, and this is an opportunity for us to talk about what this thing of ours is. You know, this is an extension of the First Amendment Society. For those who may be new to the program, who may be just tuning in for the first time, there's an organization that we are a part of that's based here in Washington, D.C. area that is called the First Congress Society. It is an organization that is based on promoting and bringing back full-on statesmanship, civility, politics, civil debate without the hatred, without the acid reflux of
I think a lot of the talk we hear today about civility takes on a touch of the post, you know, to each other. It goes way beyond that because a function without compromise.
Right.
And you can't have compromise unless you can talk to each other. And in order to talk to each other, you really need to be civil. If you're not civil, you cause dissension rather than bringing people together.
Right.
So it's a very practical kind of thing that we feel is necessary.
And we've got a caller on the line. Caller, 727 area code. You're on the air at Backroom Politics. Welcome. Caller? Caller from the 727. Okay, we'll put him on hold, and hopefully he'll come back and join us. When we talk about civility, and you know, this has been a platform of the First Congress Society since it was established last year, long before this event. We talked about everything from what's the influence of the media on this, what's the influence on some of these political rallies. Glenn Beck, for example, is one that I personally have called out before as being part of the problem, not part of the solution. I say the same thing about Ed Schultz and Keith Olbermann on the other side, on the other network. But then we see somebody like Joe Scarborough, who literally has right on target, Joe Scarborough, the former member of Congress from Florida, from Pensacola, has said that he is not in support of the demagoguery that's going on. He makes, you know, he calls out Sarah Palin, and I quote, "You're not more culpable for Tucson." All of us around the Morning Joe table, he being the host of Morning Joe on MSNBC, that are stunned that you would whine about yourself and how you were perceived as the family members of those who lost their life in Tucson were literally going into services. He also called out Glenn Beck and says, and I quote, "You've attacked your political opponents with words designed to inspire hatred and mind-bending conspiracy theories from fans." Now, that's two Republican side of the House. We can say the same thing about Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann. Going back to Sarah Palin, Sarah Palin's taking a hit on this. Did she really botch an opportunity for her to be a full-run political leader, or is she just now viewed as maybe a partner?
She has credibility coming out the way she did, and she's getting a lot of backlash on both the right and left, and that will definitely hurt her ability to win the Republican nomination.
So this begs the question: we're hearing about all the civilians, everybody's on the bandwagon. I go back to a question I asked last week: can we sustain this civil tone? Or is this just another, hey, it's the cool popular thing that's going to get me media coverage, and then we're back to calling everybody idiots and putting targets on masks?
Well, we have a good opportunity to at least see the beginnings of what could be something better or just back to the old ways. The debate began on the floor of the House. About Republicans have offered a resolution to repeal the health care bill. Now, they're not going to be able to. The Senate won't do it. That doesn't mean it's a senseless and worthless debate. We need a good debate about the health care bill. Now, let's see how civil it is. Let's see if people are trying to make arguments about the substance of the program as it is and how it could be improved, or whether they just yell at each other. This will be a very interesting opportunity.
Al?
My guess is that it's going to be easier to get civility into Congress than it is in the media, in particular the media we're talking about. I think probably what has kind of flown into the House has grown out of the Rush Limbaughs and the Glenn Becks and the liberals who do the same kind of thing. And I think that the politicians in Congress are going to be very careful about getting pointed to as somebody who is being uncivil and going back to the old ways. But it ain't going to stop Rush Limbaugh, and it ain't going to stop Keith Olbermann, and it ain't going to stop those people. So they'll still be there kind of curdling public debate.
So let me ask this. You know, this question comes up, and on CNN.com today, Roland Martin, one of their contributors regularly on a lot of the talking head shows in the evening, asked the question after Tucson, will the media tone it down? I have actually had friends, and actually when I've been on some of these, you know, 24-hour news cycle shows where, you know, where there's opposing views, they're saying mix it up, fight it out. And they actually want, because that makes for good television, that makes for good radio, that makes for great media. You know, look, people watch these 24-hour news, they want to see the train wreck. They want to see the yelling and the throat grabbing that's going on, that's helping promote this. Can the media turn it down? Bob, former VP of NBC, that's got to be something that you guys have got to take a look at.
Well, I would hope, and have no knowledge, but I would hope that the management of the channels that we're talking about, MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, what have you, I would hope that the management would say, hey, look, guys and gals, let's continue to have robust debate, but let's stop throwing mud at each other and denigrating each other. Let's talk about the substance. Now, that requires a mindset change. It's a hell of a lot easier if you're Rachel Maddow on one side or if you're, you know, Glenn Beck on the other side. It's much easier not to know the substance, but just to have a couple of points you want to make, call them, you know, here's death panels or something of that nature, and just bang on that rather than discussing whether it makes sense to have the physicians and the doctors required or at least available to talk with families when they have a 95-year-old person in the hospital bed and say what the options are and what makes some sense.
You're talking about what's called a death panel, mistakenly.
Right. I mean, if something like that can, if we can have conversations like that on the channels, the news channels, we're going to maybe help people to understand more about what's in the bill. Let's face it. I don't think there's 500 people in this country today living that understand the bill just because it's a very complicated bill.
Right.
And there are a lot of things in it that could be fixed if parties would look at it and try to fix it. Now, I understand why the Republicans do it, doing what they're doing. They said they were going to do it. It was important. They want to make a statement. Having done that, both sides need to move on to the discussion of how do you fix it.
Al?
No, I agree with that. I may be wrong. I hope I am not. But I think the debate that you will hear on repeal of the job-killing health care bill, that's a phrase that maybe the Republicans would like to rethink and let slip into a bottom drawer somewhere. I suspect it's going to be a much more civil debate than it was otherwise going to be on both sides.
I agree with you. I think it will be. It would be nice to see that having had that debate, both sides realize that that's a good way to debate. A wide variety of issues.
And I would certainly agree with that, that the hope is that both sides realize that's the better way to debate. But to go back to the point Al just made, which is, you know, the mistakenly called death panels, I would say it's not factual to call them death panels, but it was no mistake. There is a strategist who came up with that phrase to purposely target the message to a certain audience that way. And months later, after the fact, maybe more people are understanding that it's not accurate. But the point is the phrase stuck. People will believe what they want to believe based on what that phrase infers. And how hard is it going to be to overcome that? What Bob mentioned, which is where both sides realize this is not the way to have the debate.
One of the things that I found in Congress, and I happened to work on campaign finance reform
right.
with Guy Underjack, who was the Republican. Trying to come up with a bipartisan bill. It went nowhere. But both parties hired guns, those wonderful, merciless, unconscionable, both parties, sometimes get the lead roles. They take it away from the politician, and the politicians are doing what their hired guns tell them to do and telling them to say, rather than they using them in their appropriate thing, win elections and not engage in a debate 24/7.
We're going to try the caller. We got the caller back on. Caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, I don't foresee anything changing with cable television. I don't know how, you know, you guys would think that there's any sort of demand for primetime television shows on cable to have nut and bolts policy talking and compromise talking and all that other type of stuff. I mean, who in the world would watch it?
You raise a question that has confounded people who try to put quality programming on air all the time, because this is a case of where the lowest common denominator often draws the biggest audience. But it seems to me that if the public would understand that they have control over this and would... It's not so much they would listen to us, for example, as it is that they should stop listening to the people that are shoveling the shit.
Bob, and I would say to the caller that I would hope that if he agrees with us that it would be a good idea for some more civility, that he might send another representative and say, I think you ought to change, you ought to be more civil, and I think you might want to write a letter to some of the cable networks. If you keep talking like that, they could listen to you anymore.
Or, I mean, literally activation such as the First Congress Society, which we're going to be taking members here shortly.
There are solutions to this, and fundamentally, caller, you're right, but the only way to make it happen is if hundreds and hundreds of folks like yourself, you know, in effect tell the cable networks that you don't like what they're doing. You don't mind them having an opinion, but you want them to have you want to be able to be civil about it.
I think our caller's been trying to get a word in edgewise.
Go ahead.
No, honestly, guys, at 8 o'clock at night, I don't really want... I mean, we've got C-SPAN on three channels now. I mean, isn't to some degree that what you guys are talking about? I mean, it's not that... I mean, you can have government-funded television station that has people talking about policy and debating policy all day long, but it would just be a station that nobody watches. So the only thing that you're... The only solution you really have is to either ban stations or, you know, there is no solution. I mean, it is what it is. It's a free market system, and that's what is, you know, advertisers are paying for. And to constantly have these discussions about demanding civility from what is essentially entertainment to some degree, I think it's just a waste of time.
And who knows, you may be right, but it does seem to me that there have been programs in the past that had a great deal of controversy and had good audiences. David Susskind years ago, but I'm trying to think.
Meet the Press is still one of the most highly viewed TV shows and has been around for 50 years.
Yes, and Face the Nation on CBS is an excellent show.
And they're very, they deal with controversial issues and the interviewers are very hard.
They ask hard questions, and they get answers, and they can disagree with their colleagues. But the fact of the matter is, it still comes down to the reason the cable network shows are the way they are is because they draw audiences. So the audience has to say enough.
Absolutely, it comes down to the will of the people. As long as they rise up and say we're not going to take this anymore, then the networks are going to abide by what.
Caller, I'm on your side. Do you have some more to say?
Caller?
No, I mean, you say it's up to the people. I just don't think the people are there. I don't think the numbers are there. I think the majority of people like the way it is. I think the majority of people like listening to Rush Limbaugh or like listening to Ed Schultz.
There is one solution that I think would work, which is not going to happen, and that is a restoration of the Fairness Act, which was greatly misunderstood in the first place.
Can you talk about the Fairness Act for those who might not know?
The Fairness Doctrine was an FCC rule which said that that they had to present fairly all sides to a controversial issue. There was a great confusion. Equal time applies to time given in front of the boss. If you're up 6 minutes, I get 10 minutes if we're an opponent. But the Fairness Doctrine left it was very loose, and it left it up to the stations themselves to determine how they met this responsibility. And it didn't mean minute for minute. It just meant that you're going to have somebody who is clearly repeating, let's say, the conservative line. Somewhere in your programming, you need to see that the liberal point of view is presented as well.
And caller, one thought. I agree with you that there's an awful lot of folks out there who like to listen to Glenn Beck and like to listen to Keith Olbermann. But there's got to be folks like yourself who, you know, say that, you know, you'd like to hear something maybe a little bit more balanced. If you and others like you would start writing letters to the cable networks, you would be surprised how effective it would be. I was an NBC executive for 20 years, and I can tell you that when you start getting letters from citizens who are listening to you and they're complaining about something, you pay attention because it's your audience and you don't want to lose it. So if the audience starts telling you to straighten up, you'll straighten up.
Caller, what's your name and where are you from?
My name's Tom. I'm calling from Atlanta.
All right. Caller, we really appreciate it. We're going to put you on hold. We appreciate you listening. Hope you'll stay tuned with us. We also invite you to, you know, part of the platform of this radio show and of the First Congress Society is that, you know, we urge people to get involved. We urge people to be individually involved or become involved in organizations that will help promote exactly your thoughts and the thoughts of those of us around the table. But we really appreciate your call today. Thank you very much.
And I compliment you. You were extremely civil, which is part of what this is about.
That's exactly what we're talking about. Exactly what we're talking about. You know, we talk about, you know, the executives. Bob, you were an executive with NBC for 20 years, VP of Government Relations. You know, one of the, quote, Roland Martin, I mean, this article about the media after Tucson by Roland Martin and CNN.com, he points out Roger Ailes, the head of Fox News. Right after the Tucson shooting, he told his staff, according to this article, quote, I told all of you guys to shut up, tone it down, and make your arguments intellectually. You don't have to do it with bombast. I hope the other side does that. Now, we hope that the MSNBC on the left and even CNN, which is surprisingly in the middle of all this.
And Fox.
And, well, Fox News, the head of Fox, saying, you know, I'm telling my guys, shut up. The head of NBC, we hope that they're saying, shut up, do it with facts, intellectually, have civil debate. We hope that CNN and the organization Time Warner has done the same thing. But going back to the caller's point is that sustainable for business?
Well, I think it's sustainable. People want him. The conservative or the liberal point of view on all issues, you can argue on the merits of it, and you can show the merits of your point of view. You can show the other side's point of view. You don't have to do it with bombast. You don't have to call down Armageddon. You know, we're about to be destroyed by this great disaster, whatever it is, because, you know, that isn't happening. I mean, you know, I don't know what Obamacare is going to do in the next 20 years, and I certainly, if I'd have been a member of Congress, I think Al would have probably voted for it. I probably wouldn't have voted for it. But the point of view, the point is, it isn't Armageddon. We can fix it if it's a bad bill, if we want to, if there's enough desire in the country to do some changes to the bill, the country will do it.
Al, but as going back to the media point, as a former broadcaster, if your executive tells you to shut up, do it intellectually, does that, I mean, do you take heed of that or say, wait a minute, you're getting business, I'm the ratings generator here, not you guys in the suits. You as a former broadcaster, I mean, does that resonate with you or are we going down a slippery slope here?
Well, I'm a bad example because I have always hated that kind of program.
Oh, you're never a bad example, Al.
And I would not have been doing that kind of program. But it occurs to me, let me put this thought out. The standard thing that you're going to get from your CEO is this program. I'm going to use an analogy I've used before. Forgive me for repeating myself. But people will slow down and look at a dead body alongside the road. It is human nature to be drawn to things like that. That does not mean they want you to strew dead bodies alongside the road in order to appease people's interest in the macabre. If you run something else, they'll watch something else. They're not out there demanding that they have hate-filled, crazy people, you know, with blackboards and outrage.
You know, one of the things, and I'm going to stop moderating for a second and commentate a little bit, is, you know, we see on both sides, they refer to, you know, the government, and then, you know, not our government, you know, it's the government's out to get you. And then we say, you know, that president, or even just the slightest nuances. Now, we're not going to take away some of the rhetoric. It's politics. Politics is inherently full of rhetoric. It's just how you utilize the rhetoric that is in question these days. You know, does it become toxic? Does it, you know, do we do it civilly? I'm going to say, look, we're going to charge the Hill. A friend of mine came out the other day and said, you know, everybody's targeting Sarah, you know, lack of a better term, because she used targets. We've been using warfare analogies in politics since the days of...
Every candidate is going to fight for his people.
Right, right.
Every campaign is a campaign.
Right, and that is a wartime term.
Yeah.
You know, we're not going... I'm not going to stop using rhetoric, you know, because that's what we do. That's how we get our message. That's how you incite people. But it's what you incite them to do and how you incite them... Whether it's flammable, you know, Joe Scarborough calls out and says, you're calling the president a racist, a Marxist, and a fascist. Somebody's going to hear that, and it may be out of that, the broadcasters and all the money that you're generating for Fox News or MSNBC or CNN or whichever media outlet it is, could take that to heart and say, wow, he's right. The government is out to get me. Or, you know what, he's right. The Republicans are evil and they want us to die. And they take that to heart, and then some way, because they are unstable, because they are easily influenced by what they see as a media demagogue, they go out and they do crazy stuff, whether it's exit or... God forbid we see another Tucson.
Well, and I think I said something that I probably should withdraw. I analogized the sound like Alka-Seltzer and analgesic. I made an analogy that the job billing health care bill was a phrase they might want to think again about. They might have a couple of things just because of the nature of it. It would be right now kind of incendiary. But it is a point that is debatable.
Yes.
The Republicans can say that it kills jobs. The Democrats can try to demonstrate that it doesn't kill jobs. And there's ample evidence to both sides. So probably job thing, by adding job killing to whatever the Republicans are doing, is probably not part of what we're talking about.
Bob?
I'd agree, Al. I think it's... That's an argument that should be debated on the floor of the House. And it's an issue that people are concerned about. It may be, it may not be, but the point is we can have a debate about it, and we should have a
Certainly.
Debate about it.
And I think the Democrats should marshal all of their facts and figures and take it on head on and demonstrate that it's simply not true.
And I think Republicans should marshal their facts and get everything together and show how they believe it is to be true. And then the public will have information that is sound and sensible and they can react to.
Ralph.
One of the most damaging things is when I hear people saying Obama is not a legitimate president, that he was not born in the United States, and that's already led to servicemen saying that, refusing to go to Iraq because Obama.
It's a great point.
Yeah.
That was a media hyped up issue that was toxic at best, and now you've got a decorated military officer now serving time in a military prison because he refused to deploy because he felt that it was an unlawful order given by an unlawful president. Well, that was media driven, and there are members of Congress that were pushing the legitimacy of Obama, the versatility issue.
Well, and you just used three words that somebody called the president a fascist. You know.
A fascist, a Marxist, and...
And it's very offensive to people that are from Hawaii.
Yeah.
And vote for him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
My point is, there's no way to rebut that. It's an assertion, and you can say it's not true, but how do you go about proving somebody's not an idiot? So calling someone an idiot seems to me to be an inappropriate thing, whereas job killing is absolutely debatable, and is therefore a legitimate part of discussion. That's a very clear distinction.
Absolutely. We're coming up on the bottom of the hour. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll continue this discussion after the break. But, the question is, are we going to see the end of pictures of Obama with a Hitler mustache, or are we going to stop seeing pictures of George Bush with a swastika next to him? Are those days over, or is this something that we're going to have to gradually decommission and deflate the general public and the general electorate?
I think it's gradual. People have been drawing mustaches on posters for years, often with less mean intent than what you suggest. There will always be a few. But what I would hope is it would not be coming out of the back room, work room of either party and any other group that wants to be taken seriously as a political factor.
Here, here.
Well, let's come back to our segment here on Backroom Politics here in a few minutes. This is Backroom Politics live from Philly Backroom in Washington. we're back live from Shelley's Back Room in Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. With us, as always, is our esteemed panel, the Honorable Al Swift, the Honorable Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie, and somewhere walking around is our executive producer and our executive director of the Congress Society, Perry Blastine.
Does he trust us to be here by ourselves?
I don't know. He is the whip, if you will, here for a political term and actually for an actual term. Actually, one of the topics we were talking about civility in politics, and obviously the changes in leadership, the changes in the political scene here have been happening almost weekly. Whether it's the installation of the 112th Congress and the Republican takeover of the House. A lot of changes happening with the RNC. Somebody give me the proper pronunciation of his name. I believe our executive producer, who is our de facto fact checker, how do we pronounce the new chairman's name?
So what's funny is that almost every article that's come out since the election hasn't been about who he is or what he stands for, but it's been about how the heck do you pronounce it. And what's great is they're all spelling the pronunciation differently.
The phonetics on it are completely different?
Yes. So the most common that I've heard is Rans Priebus.
Yeah.
Rans Priebus.
Yeah.
But it's Rans,
right.
It is
exactly.
Rans Priebus.
Rans Priebus.
Okay.
So if we want to be correct about it, well, we should just say Priebus.
My question is, why didn't he get a change years ago?
Well,
what was your name originally?
I was going to
say. Before you were Al Swift.
Mr. Glockenspiel.
Yes.
Al Glockenspiel. So you got to tighten that up.
But
Swift
then when
course.
He became a radio man,
obviously, we're for the last segment here, we're kind of going into freeform a little bit. If you want to join the freeform discussion here, you can call us at 619-638-8477. Any topic, anything political you want to talk about, our roundtable's here to either answer or have a civil debate with you on the issues. But I guess for Bob, myself, and Perry, who are Republicans, Ralph, I'm sorry, I forgot the Republican.
Yeah.
What?
He's a Democrat.
I'm not a Republican.
I thought you were a Republican.
I am a moderate Democrat.
How the hell did you get hired? By this crowd.
The salary was
right. All right. Again, being the fact checker in charge, for the three of us, on behalf of Bob, Ralph, and myself, congratulations to Chairman Priebus on taking over the head of the RNC. Rans Priebus is the former head of the Republican Party in Wisconsin. And quite frankly, unless you are deep in the weeds in the Republican Party, and I know, the only thing I've heard about him is he is a money-raising machine. Bob, do you know anything about him at all other than what we're reading right now?
I know what I've read in the stories about him, and he is both a successful raiser of funds, and in Wisconsin, he had a very successful year, won a governorship, Senate race, and a couple of Congress seats. He has brought together the traditional establishment Republican organization and the Tea Party organizations, such as they are in Wisconsin. And that is a feat that is, I think, stood him in very good stead, and it's probably the reason that he won the race, because he was able to say, I was able to make them come together, we won the elections in a state that is not a Republican state.
Well, I mean, one of the casualties of Chairman Priebus's tenure in Wisconsin was your friend Dave Obey. Dave Obey, now former congressman from Wisconsin, as a result of, I mean, as a Democrat, Al, that's got to, does this maybe look forward to 2012? Does this scare you as a Democrat a little bit? Does it make you think twice about maybe we need to follow the lead of the RNC and find like a money raiser as opposed to a spokesperson?
Well, the Democratic Party's done pretty well, I believe.
Unfortunately, in my view.
Yeah.
Respectfully.
But but I happened to be at a party last night with Dave Obey and talked to him a little bit.
How's he doing, by the way?
He's doing fine.
Good. Good.
Doing the same old Dave Obey, you know. I said, what are you going to do? He says, I don't know, and I'm not thinking about it, and I'm not going to think about it for a while. But what he said was, he said, I would have had to raise $2 million. And he said, I wasn't doing it.
Wow.
He just said, I'm not going to do that, and I decided to quit.
A lot of your former colleagues, a lot of your friends, are senior members of the Democratic Party in the House. Is this going to be something we're going to see more of as we get closer to 2012, that a lot of our more well-known and more senior statesmen in the House are going to be backing away saying, look, I'm just too old for this crap. I'm not playing this game. Let the new kids do it.
It certainly with some of the senior ones, maybe because they're too old for it, but I wasn't too old when I decided to retire. And very frankly, the major reason I decided to retire was I couldn't stand the campaigns anymore. I couldn't stand the fact that the way modern campaigns are run, it tests nothing what ability to be a member of Congress. So you spend this schizophrenic life of being a congressman and thinking one way, and then and become a candidate, and spend most of the time raising. And I just, I've had it. I came back from my last campaign so grumpy that I picked a fight with one of the journalists in this town at a rather important dinner. I was out of line. I shouldn't have done it. I called him out on it. I have been charged with how do you conduct campaign on the issues when against the charges like that? That was their national debt started before I was born, you know. Four other people were helping to contribute to that. Seems like absurd thing to talk about. And I had different people find different times when they realize this is enough. You'll see some of that.
We just got word today that the senator from North Dakota, Senator
Kent Conrad,
has announced that he will not seek re-election in 2012.
Well, in the state of Texas,
Kay Bailey Hutchison has decided that she's backing out.
We don't know what the reasons are for either of them.
And you've got two people there who are very senior, have a lot of responsibility, particularly Mr. Conrad, who is chairman of the Budget Committee. This is a very important committee.
And a lot of respect.
And a lot of respect.
Right.
He was a member of the President's Commission and did a lot of good work. And he is one of the original authors of the original resolution, which led to the creation of what was the President's
Commission. I mean, these announcements, I mean, Ken Conrad's got to be sending the Democratic Party into a tailspin, arguably. That's a huge, huge impact on the Democrats being able to possibly maintain control.
Well, that old is.
No, and the early look at the election in that state would indicate that it's likely to, under normal circumstances, to be a Republican seat that Congress is able to hold, and maybe a Democrat who can.
And even is on the national ticket, it doesn't
no,
have
it,
any impact
probably,
in North Dakota.
No, it probably wouldn't matter in Dakota.
But, you know, we're literally looking at a war of attrition almost in the Senate. You know, Kay Bailey Hutchison announcing mm-hmm. last week, Senator Conrad now this week.
There will be more.
Thank you.
Because you want to have fun. That's not how I mean the term.
Right, right.
Fun comes done and working the process to achieve things. And the institution quite a bit of legislation through in December. But sitting around through
fun is on getting
we're seeing almost a brain trust vote. Hierarchy to Senator, City Council, working away from the state legislature, and then Congress. There are a few examples where they come straight out of their district to Congress.
But I had been a staffer on the Hill.
Right. So you see this. It's a question. The senior leadership, that senior legacy of knowledge that's there, one that comes to mind is your friend John Dingell.
Oh, yeah.
John Dingell is up there. He's almost into his 80s now.
He is into his 80s. He is 10 years older than I am, so he's about 85.
You know, I mean, the thought of losing a statesman like John Dingell,
whose mind is so sharp.
Exactly. But the thought of losing that type of leadership is
and
got
in his
to.
Case, that kind of institutional memory.
Yeah.
I can remember him with a brilliant idea. I can't remember what it was, but it was a brilliant idea. And I said, John, what do you think about doing this? And he said, how would you practice this in? I didn't know there was an Administrative Practices Act, let alone what it contained, let alone what my proposal was going to interfere with it. I didn't know. I was a second or third term, you know, and John knows those things.
And he is one of the most gifted legislators that the Congress in its 220 some years has ever had.
Yeah,
I have no doubt about it.
His predecessor on the committee, Barton, a very conservative Texas Democrat,
right,
said publicly, it was John's 50th year in Congress.
Yes.
He said before a huge audience, he said, John is one of the 10 best congressmen ever. And he said, I don't mean existing now, I mean ever.
I was there and I heard it and I thought to myself, I think he's exactly right.
You know, we've had this discussion around the table before of, you know, that type of leadership, that type of statesmanship.
Yeah.
You know, just out of curiosity, because we are in freeform, who would you put up in your top five legislators? Not personalities, not anything. Who are your top five legislators of all time? What's your all-star list?
Of all time. Well, you'd have to probably include the one of the great Kentuckians of all time,
Henry Clay.
Right.
Henry Clay, who was elected Speaker the day he was sworn in on the House of Representatives for the first time.
Which belies our entire argument.
the quality of the talent that he had. He is both a House and a Senate member for 40 years, was probably the greatest legislator in the period right after the founders up to the Civil War.
Al, who would you put on that list?
Well, now, that's one.
Right.
Yeah, I don't have the I certainly include John Dingell in that, but we've already mentioned him.
Right, right.
Absolutely.
Dick Bowling was...
He tried for leadership, but he was a cranky guy.
Right,
and,
congressman from...
Missouri.
Missouri.
And he just wasn't popular enough to get it. And my God...
Good Lord. Breaking news here in Washington. Joe Lieberman has announced to Paul Baglia that he will not seek a fourth term in the U.S. Senate in 2012. This is news here in Washington again.
Wow.
Senator Joe Lieberman has just announced that's two
today.
Major Democratic caucuses. I mean, Joe Lieberman being an independent, but that is that now Ken Conrad announces today Joe Lieberman. What is going on,
Justin?
And you know, both of them would win if they were running.
That's the amazing thing about it is, what's going on here?
They believe that the Democrats are not going to retain control of the Senate.
Yeah.
That's the simple fact.
So that is Kay Bailey Hutchinson's excuse.
She's been through the mirror in terms of deciding which office she's going to perform.
I don't mean to demean your observation. I think there's a lot of truth to it, but I think there's more going on than that.
I got to tell you, we're starting to see the hemorrhaging, particularly on the Senate, of some true mind leaders, some true thought leaders in that House, now deciding on calling it a day.
Lieberman is one of the most significant senators when you talk about people who try to work across the aisle and find solutions.
But you made your finger on the answer in your question. Leaders. How do you think in the United States it doesn't function?
Well, let me ask this question then. Do you think theoretical, whatever we want to call it, but in our experiences here in Washington, do you think this tradition of seeing a couple of announcements that have announced prior to the holidays, is this a tradition due to the rhetoric just being out of control?
I don't know.
If you were to guess, as an educated man, what would you think?
I had it part of the Senate. It's an institution that does not function. And if you can't get something done, the Senate can't be.
We go back to the point we were talking about earlier about the satisfaction you get in the job. And I think in the Senate, some is functional just because of its own rules. I think you have people just saying, I really don't want to get up every morning. Realize that I'm going to spend the whole day trying to solve problems that we're not going to even get close to solving because we're not going to be able to do anything. The rules won't let us.
And we're also seeing, I mean, a tremendous amount of attrition coming out of the White House, out of the administration. Rahm Emanuel going off to Chicago, running for Congress, Austin Goolsbee. Was it Austin Goolsbee who left?
No, staying.
Yeah.
After the midterm,
correct.
Midterm for